love someday. I met a strange lady, she made me nervous. She took me in and gave me breakfast. And she said, do you come from a land down under? Where women go and men wonder. Can't you hear the thunder? You better run, you better take cover.
Croeso and welcome to Tales for Wales, the pod that never fails to travel the long neck of history to peck at the lesser known morsels of the past and run flightlessly towards the rare gems of the before. I'm Jack, and as always, I'm joined by my little, what can I say that's funny to do with birds? Well, my little chuff of a co-star.
Good night, mate. How are you?
Co-star, co-host. Yeah, all right, mate.
Oh, bloody hell. Yeah. Well, how are you doing, mate? Not bad yourself. All right. Up the Danny.
I was doing all right to the end there. I thought I should have typed more.
Don't worry, mate.
Yes, you're joining Tales of Wales, the usual. It's us two. You know, you're lovable. Wales is sweetheart.
You tried to fly, but you were a flightless bird, so you couldn't take off.
I was born without the ability. Yeah.
Well,
and
mate,
today
right?
We're discussing something to do with birds, flightless birds, perhaps.
Yeah.
But how have you been, mate?
Yeah, good, man. We got to start this episode with, I believe in a land down under, because this is an Australian-based episode, by the way. So, and you've been to New Zealand, haven't you, with your gap year?
I've been to New South Wales, I think.
It wasn't a gap year, was it? It was like, you just, tell people the story about that. It's so funny. Give us the whole shebang.
I went, the New Zealand one.
Yeah.
I didn't go, I went to Australia like years after. But in New Zealand, I went to. I can't remember why I decided to go,
because there was a girl. I think it was. There's always a
girl. That was Australia.
Yeah,
that was Australia. I went to Australia for a gal.
Yeah, for a Sheila. Bloody hell,
for
right?
A Sheila.
Travel off the way out of the world for you, lad.
Yeah, but New Zealand. I'm trying to think now. It was almost like, you know, in films you see like a midlife crisis and they just like they up sticks and go on an adventure.
Yeah.
It was like that, but I was only like 19. I just went. I used a lot of my student loan to just fuck off to New Zealand.
Yeah, but didn't what did the bank? I always like the story about the bank when you called up to say, "Oh hi, I want to."
Oh yeah, that was. I needed to. That lies with every sound travel plan. I was up in my overdraft to fund it, and I'd done that a few times for the very like frivolous activity of just going out.
Yeah.
And so Barclays were catching wind and being like, lots of transactions in like fucking Womanby Street and like on Mill Lane and stuff like that in Cardiff, where all like the clubs are and everything, and lots of transactions from metros.
Yeah.
And so when I phoned up and was like, oh, can I up my overdraft? They were like, no, because, you know, we can't trust you with extra money.
Can't be trusted.
That I was like, but it's my money, and I thought I was being such a great argument. I was like, it's
your
money
that I want to have.
And I was like, it's my money though; I can spend it where I want. It's like you're my bank, not my mum.
Yeah, that's such a good line to say to them.
Giving him such a zinger. Needless to say, he was like, no, you're not. can't have
it's
it.
It's not your money, hence why it's an overdraft. It's literally
best thing
our
is
money.
Though. All I did was arrange like a face-to-face meeting with someone.
What, to fight him?
Fucking please, now I'm going to fucking box your ears, mate. No, I said, like, pleaded poverty. I was like, oh, it's just so hard. No, you're struggling to build that. And he went, okay, we'll give you another, like, 300. And I was like, ka-ching. I think I went out that night.
Off to the airport I go.
Yeah, I was like, we're on for tonight, lads. I'll pay. Drinks are on me.
Yeah.
Then I went to New Zealand. And the job I had lined up, because my visa or something was only for, like, part-time.
Yeah.
The job I'd, like, meticulously lined up, some actual planning I'd done for a goddamn change. They were like, yeah, we can't have you doing this. It was like office work. It was like, we can't have you doing this because your visa doesn't suit right or whatever. Yeah. It was like, they need me full time, something. So I was like, oh, alone in a strange country, no job, no prospect. But luckily, a cake saw my ass for a little holiday. Yeah. But no, it was a little cake baking company took me on to work, to like absolute factory work with all the gals, the old gals. It was like, you know, like the factory in Corrie?
Yeah.
Like they all just, it was kind of like that, because I actually fell in with a couple of like basically nanas And they were like showing me the ropes of the factory floor and everything. And it was
all right, doll. All right. Yeah.
One of them gave me a lift home one time. She was like, oh, I can't have you. I can only do the Australia. I can't really do the
sorry,
slightly different Kiwi accent.
Twang.
And they were like, you're like, I can't have you walking home on your own at this time of night. And I was like, oh, thanks. Whatever your name, Marge, or whatever your name was.
She's Sheila.
But it was great because I made a saving on my lunchtime costs, because they said in the little break room on lunch you can have as many of the cakes as you want. Can I just tell you, after fucking like 3 months of cake for lunch every day almost, I was sick to the back teeth of baked goods.
Surprised you didn't have like diabetes and all your teeth literally
teeth falling out.
I got diabetes.
Like, just like the nanas. Yeah. They weren't actually nanas, they'd just been on cake diet for like fucking
they're
years.
All 28, but really they've been aged by the cake.
But I had to work a fair bit to like sort of have enough money to do anything fun.
Yeah, you didn't really do anything, did you? You just went there to work at a cake factory.
Well, I did see a few things, but I didn't go for like a proper travel, like anywhere really. I stayed in the little town I was in.
Yeah.
It was a bit of a shambles, actually, when I think about it. And also because I was there on my own, I made some friends, some like Kiwi friends.
Yeah.
Because I was there on my own, I've got no one over here now to be like, ah, remember New Zealand? Yeah. Remember how that was? Remember those times?
Yeah, but tell me, what was your local pub like? Did you go?
The Celt. I went to the Celt there. That's where I met my sort of first lot of friends over there. Because it was, I thought, oh, if I'm going to bump into any Welsh people or just people from back home, then it's got to be there. So I met like a Welsh guy who was a vet. Harry.
A war vet an animal vet?
An animal vet, a veteran.
Yeah.
And he came in handy a bit later on because it was getting quite pricey to like... it was pricey to stay in hotels. Mm. It was nice and cheap to stay in hostels, but they were quite dog shit. Yeah. But they're quite dog shit. So he was like, oh, why don't you just come stay with me and pay me like 50 quid like a month or something like that. It was nothing. And he was like, because I got a spare room and everything. So that was cheap then.
Nice. What, you roomies with a vet?
We were roomies, yeah. And then he went to go back to Wales to visit his family for like
6-7 weeks. Home. You were like,
6-7 weeks. So I had that place to myself, so it was kind of good. But so that was a bit of a saving. But yeah, it was basically I'd work. It was like, although it was only part time, I had to do like 12-hour shifts. So I'd do like two of those a week. And then the rest of the time, I'd just be in the pub, basically. It's great.
Nice. So, yeah. So you saw the.
not exactly like the traveling gap year most people do. I could have done that at home.
Yeah, you went to New Zealand, which is pretty much just Wales in another country. It's like the most similar country to Wales.
Yeah. Also, the best part was, is I left for New Zealand just as we were coming into summer in Wales. And obviously it's the opposite thing. So I had winter, because I came back from New Zealand to a wintry Wales. So I was like, absolute depressing year for me in terms of weather. But
so funny.
Yeah.
So what did you see on your travels? I saw the pub. I saw a Welsh-themed pub called the Celt.
I saw all of Palmerston North's sites to see, which weren't that great. I wasn't as into history back then, so I didn't even like appreciate a lot of it.
That's insane. You went so far away. It's such a mission to get to, and he did all that.
I basically did all the stuff I would normally do, but I just didn't have any friends there, really. I had a few people I knew. They took me under their wing. They were a bit older than me at the time. I was 19. These guys were like touching 30. They probably felt sorry for me, actually.
It's the most tragic gap year I've ever heard of. Yeah. And it wasn't even a gap year.
A gap 3 months.
Yeah.
Done it now.
That's insane.
That's New Zealand off the list. Yeah, basically, done. Been there, done that.
Seen it all, mate. Done.
Yeah.
Oh, man. Do you want to do a Patreon shout out or a before we go on? Because we're recording this prior to work, so
we are.
Yeah, we've just done a Patreon episode ourselves. So if you want to join our Patreon, it's like a series of tiers. I can't remember what it is. It's been ages since I've
there's £1 tier, the Welshophile tier. That's just to give us some dosh to keep the lights on and stuff. There's the £5 tier, Jibber Jabber. You get an extra 2 episodes a month. And you've got the Taily tier, the £10 tier, where you get a series of other bonuses as well.
The other ones you get.
Some artwork.
Personalized artwork. dedicated episode to your hometown. We turn you into a Welsh legend after 6 months in the Mabinogion tale. And then after 12 months, we give you a coat of arms. And then, or is
that free t-shirt, was it? I can't remember.
I think free t-shirt at 12 months. Free t-shirt at 12 months. And then at 18 months? No, what's
18 months, I think we said, was it? I can't remember now. We gave you a coat of arms.
No, we won't take you. We'll say, we're figuring this out live on the pod. We'll say after 15 months, you'll do a coat of arms. Yeah.
But there's also the free tier. You can join for free and you still get access to all like the polls and like the little extra bonus snippets we put out. So sometimes we'll put like, we'll talk about something on a mainline episode and we'll put like the supplementary stuff on it.
Yeah.
So yeah, even if you want to just check out some extra bits and bobs, just join the free tier. You might be tempted for the extra
stuff. How do you find Patreon?
Google Patreon Tales for Wales and you'll find us there. It's the first thing that pops up basically.
Yeah.
Let me just double check what the actual name is. We haven't got. Oh yeah, it's Tales for Wales, all the words, not the number four, like with some of the stuff we got. So yeah. It's patreon.com/Tales for Wales and yeah, that you'll find all the gear there. And we got a shout out now, haven't we?
Yeah. We got our own Jacqueline.
This is gonna be a tough one for us making a nickname because it's just Lewis.
Oh.
Good to have you on board, Lewis.
I read the wrong name. No surname. Sorry. Lewis. What? All right. Well, yeah. Lewis.
Lewis.
Last time we went quite Zionistic, so let's not say Lewis.
Let's avoid that one. Yeah,
because we should probably stop bringing some of the most harrowing war stories of
Israel.
The world.
Only lets you get one, and then they come down and you like fucking a carpet bomb. So let's.
Oh, we've done it again. For fuck's
sake. We've done it. We can't help it. Lewis and Clark, an expedition into Tales for Wales.
Yeah, Lewis, Lulabelle.
Lulabelle, why not? Yeah. I love how we just say nonsense until we hit something.
I do declare the Southern Belle of Lulabelle.
Lewis Belle, a Lulabelle has come wandering onto our pod.
Lulabelle. All right, so Lulabelle.
I'm glad we got an excuse to do the Southern accent again. We haven't done that for a while.
Yeah, Lulabelle. Right, that's thanks, Lewis.
That's your lot. Sorry, Lewis. Yeah. It's too early to be doing more than that, but thank you for joining the Patreon, mate. You're a legend, Lou. Lewis the legend.
Right, well, that was lovely to hear from those blokes there, but now you're joining me, and I'm going to tell you a right ripper of a story about a little tale about the Emu Wars. Right, and if you listen closely...
So Dame Edna, it's unreal.
If you listen closely, you might find a little Tales for Wales reference in this old war.
Sorry, I'll stop. I've been doing that far too much, and you clearly weren't.
I thought it was good. I was just thinking, it sounds exactly like Dame Edna. God rest her soul.
God rest her soul. Right then. So this here is the Emu War. And it takes place in the 1930s, and it's a battle unlike any other that are fought in the Australian outback. After World War I, thousands of soldier settlers, which is a term I'll come to in a second, moved to Western Australia, attracted by government incentives to develop the land. And Australia is fucking huge. Like, you don't realise how big it is, but when I flew over it takes fucking like 6 hours just to fly over it. And it's just so much of the middle is like barren, acrid, dry, really like, you know, only...
Yeah, they all live on the coast.
The coast
almost,
sides,
they,
yeah.
Like,
I think that there's Aboriginals who managed to live off the centre of the land and stuff, and there's places around there that where people did live. But when Westerners came there, like new settlers came there, they pretty much stuck
to
the coast.
Well, that's too hard.
Let's stick to the coast. So, so like I said, these settler soldiers, after the First World War, moved to Western Australia. But unbeknownst to these new settlers, they're about to be ambushed by thousands of emus, which, if you didn't know, are tall, flightless birds. That's because for centuries, these migrating birds would just wander around looking for food. But now they had these new settlers. They had the equivalent of like a McDonald's drive-through with all these like newly developed farm crops. So like all of a sudden, these wandering birds
like,
are all
yes,
delicious.
Please.
Yeah, I'll have
much.
A bloody Macca's, mate. How are you? So this is a classic Aussie tale of how the Australians, their military and their government tried to combat the blight. So first off, the government's response was swift and unusual. They dispatched soldiers armed with machine guns to eliminate 20,000 emus that were causing havoc to the farms, which is such an Aussie way of doing it. Fucking get the Gatling gun, mate. Yeah. Fucking mate, Dan. So the reason why this is on for Tales of Wales is because these soldiers were led by Gwynedd Purves, maybe not Purves, Gwynedd Purves, P-U-R-V-E-S, Purves.
Purves, yeah.
Yeah, so Gwynedd Purves Wyn Aubrey Meredith, which is where Tales of Wales element comes in. Like, that's, you know, that's a Welsh name.
Another noble Welsh leader in a fight. Fight against the tyranny of the emus, yeah.
So when I heard this story originally, and I'll talk more about how I heard this for the first time later on, I heard that name and I thought, yes, fucking get it. We have a Welsh connection. Gwynedd Wyn Aubrey Meredith. That's got to be Welsh. So I Googled him and he said he's from Swansea. So I was like, oh, yes, please. And then I read on, it was Swansea, Tasmania. So that's the new Swansea. But I use the old Sherlock Holmes theory of deduction. You know that thing where you eliminate the impossible, whatever remains, however improbable, must be the truth. So I thought, right, he's called Gwynedd Wyn Aubrey Meredith. And he's from Swansea. He's born in Swansea. There has to be a Welsh link there. So I couldn't find like concrete evidence he had Welsh roots, but I'm going to put it out there. He does. You're not naming your child Gwynedd. Yeah. You're not going to have a surname Meredith, and you're not going to have the middle name Wyn unless you have Welsh roots. So fucking,
he's got to be like, son of a Welsh immigrant or something like that, isn't it? Yeah. It's got to happen.
Before
you go on, I just got to feed the dog really quick because he's fucking whinging downstairs. Okay. 2 seconds.
Yeah, no worries.
All right, mate. I've just gone. How are you, mate? Jack's just gone to feed his dog, and I thought I'd jump back on and say, how are you? Oh, I'm not too bad myself. I've been up to the Danny all day.
Practicing my voices, practicing my voices. Was Jack's on the loo? I'm just singing my song. I'll be alright in the morning.
Back, sorry, man.
Hello.
I just heard you doing something on the thing there. I heard,
I'll be back in the morning. So this guy, he was a soldier, then he turned to a major, and he had a military career spanning decades. And would, like I said, most likely have Welsh roots due to his name and where he was born in Australia. So born in Swansea, Australia, which, so we got ourselves a Welsh connection. But back to the story. What they expect to be a quick and decisive victory turned into a humbling and absurd episode known as the Emu War. So for a little more context, following World War One, the Australian government sought to settle more than 5,000 soldiers who'd now turned into farmers in the westernmost state of Australia. However, the region's harsh conditions proved really difficult with poor soil and inconsistent rainfall. And then, in 1932, there was a severe drought that drove nearly 20,000 emus into the farming areas. So these birds, they started like breaking down the fences and like eating all the crops.
We're dying out here, mate. Come on.
Bloody hell, mate. I'm fucking starving.
I just want a drop of water. I just went cockney then.
They started breaking fences and they had these smaller pests like rats and mice and stuff to come in, which was like the final straw because these fledgling farmers couldn't grow stuff there. Anything they did grow was getting eaten by the birds and by the pests. So they decided to call in the big guns, and on the 2nd of November 1932, soldiers from the Royal Australian Artillery arrived with two Lewis light machine guns. Their directive was
literal
simple.
Big guns,
they were given a simple directive: eliminate the emus and protect the crops. Yeah, the campaign quickly descended into classic Aussie shenanigans. There's an interview in the National Geographic from Sarah Camaccio, a zookeeper at Taronga Zoo. She said, "I think back in the day they underestimated the species. They were quite unsuccessful because emus are such fast, agile birds." And I'll come on to that again in a little bit. But in the first 3 days, the men only killed 30 emus. Instead, like they were expecting to, like, this will be a get in there, mow them down, get out kind of operation. But instead of staying in these huge herds that they were originally in, the emus just scattered when the first shot happened, making them really challenging targets to hit.
Yeah.
So they realized, we can't just mow them down like the Americans did with the buffalo. We decided, so they're like, all right, we're going to have to stalk them. So they stalked the emus across the outback, And then they found that, like, this watering hole, and they were like, right, they're going to be using this watering hole soon, so let's set up an ambush here. So 2 days after the initial attack, they lay in wait whilst the herd moved over, and when the soldiers had the scope of enough of them, so they, like, had a huge wave of these emus, where even if they were to, like, shoot them, even if they were to scatter, they would take out a lot of them because they're in compact space now. They were like, right, we're going to let hell let loose as soon as we're ready. So then they got in position, they had their guns lined up, they had the sight on them and stuff, and then they were about to fire, and they thought they were going to take out, like, a fucking herd of them. But then all their guns jammed, so they had to watch just thousands of loitering emus just clucked about, and they couldn't do anything. But now this has gone on for, like, a bit of time. They, like, reports of this peculiar war, in quotations, spread, and, like, public fascination grew. So people were really intrigued by these plucky survivors who were just evading capture from and slaughter from the Aussie government and army. They also really liked it, that they heard that the emus had now formed these units that look out to evade capture. So these units of emus would circle around the main herd, keeping an eye on any danger. And when they saw the soldiers, they'd scarp and make it impossible for the soldiers to keep up with them.
I thought you were going to say unions. They'd form unions. Like, they were marching on Parliament, the emu union, saying, look, this is disgusting, this is prejudice, this is hate crime.
So then local truck drivers decided to help the countrymen out, and they got in their trucks and attempt to herd the emus towards the gunners. So they had the gunners set up, and they had these big old outback trucks ready to herd them all towards them. But with the birds sprinting over uneven ground at 55 miles per hour, the trucks didn't stand a chance, and they ended up crashing and flipping over in pursuit. So they wrote off these.
There needs to be a movie about this. Well, this could be so funny.
Funny you say that. So I'll talk about that in a little bit. Other witnesses were astonished at the emu's alleged ability to survive glancing shots. So when they were getting shot, they could, like, bounce off their skin and stuff. And so our officer, Gwyneth Wynne Aubrey Meredith, he famously said in, like, an interview, emus could face machine guns with the invulnerability of tanks, which does sound a bit of a cop-out from him. It's like,
they're bulletproof, I'm telling you, man, it's impossible.
What's so funny, hilariously, it was 45 days after the start of the campaign, they only managed to kill, like, 2,500, which was a fraction of the amount, leaving all the farmers no better off. So, like, they took 45 days of, like, trying to fight these animals, and they did fuck all.
Men with guns against just tall birds that can't fly.
Who look quite gumpy in real life. They're like,
they do look a bit goofy.
Thankfully, calls for humane treatment sounded for the animals, and the government called off the operation. So the emus emerged victorious, making this campaign incredibly costly and a peculiar failure for the Aussies. For the government, that is. Because lots of the local Australians were like, no, I'll leave them alone, mate. They're bloody good blokes. And all that malarkey.
They're
bloody good blokes, if you ask me, mate.
That's mad. That it's like, they lost as well. Like, they lost the war. The emu war was won by the emus.
So it wasn't just, this emu war wasn't just testament to military folly, but it underscored the birds' incredible resilience. These beasts stand at 6 feet tall with strides over 3 feet, and they are direct descendants from dinosaurs. They're the only bird that have a calf muscle, which helps them forward. Their powerful leg muscle gives them, like, exceptional speed and endurance. They, like I said, they can run up to 55 miles per hour, and they can follow rainfall patterns to walk up to 15 miles a day in search of food. And while emus often forage alone or in small groups, droughts can unite them. Like, that's what happened here. They end up getting 20,000 of them. So this converge of natural behavior set the stage for the emu war in the 30s. But emus are more than just survivors. They're opportunistic feeders, and they played this huge vital ecological role in dispersing seeds across vast distances. So they're really important to vegetation across Australia. While studies have found dozens of plant species in emu dung, Camaccio, the zoo lady I mentioned earlier, says emus are pivotal in spreading kwandong, a hardy native peach. She said a lot of other animals feed on that plant too. You'll see it grown in deserts where other things might not grow. And emus disperse all those seeds to the big benefit of the ecosystem. So they benefit everyone in turn. So it was like, it once again, kind of short-sightedness. I think, oh, we'll kill all these things that are really important to the ecosystem. So this bizarre chapter in history wasn't just a military misstep. It revealed the emu's critical role in Australia's ecosystem and solidified their status as one of the country's most iconic species. Beyond their ecological role, emus hold a deep cultural significance. They hold symbolism for some First Nation Aboriginals in their creation stories, often representing resilience, strength, and a deep connection to the land.
I like there's a parallel to be made there, I think, when you're describing the emu as like resilient, the survivalist, tank-like, you know, they're descended from a like warrior race of dinosaurs, you might say. So a bit like the Welsh being descended from the Celts. We're very resilient.
We are very resilient.
Basically hard as fuck.
Well,
unfortunately, they probably fared better in their war than Wales has in a lot of it during this history. But what can you do? I'm sticking to my emu-Wales parallel, all right? That's
what I'm doing. In some stories, the emu is a creator spirit guiding the natural world, and in others, it appears as a celestial figure in the Milky Way. So emu connection in Australia runs so deep that they appear on the national coat of arms and the 50-cent coin and even sports team logos. And now, the way
not
I heard
for a gumpy
this,
little bird, is it?
Yeah, for like... Also, it does look like, if you've ever watched Last Stop Larimer, that documentary I mentioned, there's a lady in there who looks so much like an emu. She's like, hello, good night, man, how are you? I'm a bloody hell, I'm a bloody big bird. She always looks so, she's always like startled, and she like woggles her neck back.
Woggles.
now, the way I heard about this story is because I got a few friends who are in Australia who do podcasts and do stand-up and work in like TV out in Australia. And some of them were involved in this low-budget film called The Emu War. And it's such a fucking mental film. It had this tiny budget, but it ended up winning a bunch of awards because it's so funny and stupid and gory and over top. And if you're a fan of, like, Aussie humour and, like, Aussie stand-up and stuff, first of all, it has, like, a cameo after cameo of Australian comedians in it. But it's also, like, that really, like, tongue-in-cheek Aussie campness and humour. And, like, it's a bit like a slasher. Like, it's got over-the-top guts and gore and has these, like, CG emus in army gear, and it's all like just
that
like
sounds right up my street.
It's really funny, man. You can rent it on YouTube, so if you go on YouTube you can get it for like a couple of quid, and I watched it and I really enjoyed it. Hilariously though, there's another much bigger emu war film coming out with John Cleese starring in it, and they were apparently absolutely fuming that this smaller emu war film had just come out and been released, because now they have to change their name, and it's like kind of rained on their parade for this actual film coming out.
I've sort of gone off John Cleese these days. I know. Anyway. He's a bit of a knob these days, so sod him. I'm glad the little guy went
so
on
go
this
support
front.
The little one. Yeah, so yeah, you can find it on YouTube. You can get involved with supporting some local Aussie legends.
I'm sorry about all the accents, mate. I just got a little bit carried away. Yeah.
To any Australians listening, we can only apologise.
Not bad.
In terms of butchering accents, we do that almost every episode. Yeah, so
why do we do accents
by now?
When we're fucking shit at them? But it's quite
it's a laugh, isn't it? It makes us feel funny. Yeah.
All right. Diolch am grando, guys. I got to go to work. We'll see you all.
Diolch, pal. Ta-da.